Support for the Source Podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico Studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Vice President and Democratic nominee for President Kamala Harris on Friday traveled to the U.S. southern border in Arizona, where she addressed the immigration problem and the nation's fentanyl crisis. Harris embraced a mother whose son died of a fentanyl overdose and made her most extensive remarks to date about how she would address border security and immigration reform. Harris said that if she wins the election, she would try to revive the bipartisan agreement that would provide more funding to hire more Border Patrol agents and buy more equipment to detect fentanyl. She said her experience as a prosecutor and attorney general gave her the experience needed to tackle the fentanyl problem. Fentanyl is an extremely potent, inexpensive, and easy-to-manufacture synthetic drug. It has thoroughly contaminated the drug supply, and it is killing thousands, tens of thousands of Americans every year. But fentanyl continues to be misunderstood. In his new book, Fentanyl Nation, Toxic Politics and America's Failed War on Drugs, recovery advocate Ryan Hampton separates facts from fiction surrounding fentanyl. And Ryan, welcome to The Source.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
So let's talk about Vice President Kamala Harris at the southern border on Friday and what she is saying about fentanyl. She is talking tough about the war on drugs, and she's saying, "I'm a prosecutor. I was attorney general. I know how to stop. I know how to deal with the cartels." This is like, so if we, harden the border, fentanyl goes away. Does that make sense to you?
Well, you know, I mean, I think it's important to note that it's got to be a balanced approach, right? So the U.S.-Mexico border, right, it's a huge topic in our politics today, especially right before an election. You know, both political parties, both Democrats and Republicans, have really made this a centerpiece of their campaign. But what both parties will often forget to mention, you know, is that fentanyl flows unchecked through major ports of entry, mostly hidden in the thousands of vehicles that cross the border every day. Over 80% of fentanyl actually comes through legal ports of entry, and in many cases, you know, by United States citizens for United States citizens. You know, the border has always been open for business and trade between the U.S. and Mexico, which is one of the biggest trading partners we have. And I think the vice president was right, you know, in bringing up the bipartisan border security package, which was killed several months ago. And I do believe that package and some of the solutions that were being proposed in the bipartisan border security deal would have helped curb some of the problem. You know, the package included massive investments into drug checking technology, you know, as well as Border Patrol agents to ensure that vehicles, you know, passing through the border weren't smuggling fentanyl. But, you know, politics got in the way, as it typically does sometimes. And instead of instead of some on the political spectrum, you know, we're seeing them use this as a political football to gain votes when really, you know, lives are at stake.
Yeah, let me put it to you this way. If we were able to completely lock down the southern border, you know, like a force field, nothing could get through. Not a single molecule of fentanyl could get through the southern border. Wouldn't we still have a fentanyl problem?
Well, we certainly would have a fentanyl problem. We're in the era of synthetics these days. And I argue, you know, not just in the book, but in my work. You know, I do this work every single day. I run a fairly large nonprofit that works with folks, you know, on the front lines of the overdose crisis and addiction crisis. I'm in recovery for myself for nearly 10 years. You know, I think what people forget is that we've transitioned away from the agricultural kind of crop-based drugs into this.
Sure, we no longer need to grow poppies. We don't need to have an organic grown product to make heroin. This is all chemical stuff. So
it's all chemicals that can be bought online, right?
I mean, I can go online right now and I can order fentanyl to be shipped to me from China.
Right. You can order the precursors to fentanyl. We call it the bathtub gin of opioids for that reason. And I think what people also forget is that one of the largest fentanyl, you know, lab, illicit fentanyl lab busts that we've had in the last couple of years was actually in Vancouver in March of 2023. Right, Canada. and the northern border, right? And we've also had major busts in Arizona where it's being manufactured. So the synthetic drugs can be, you know, you can purchase the precursors online. They can be made here in the United States. They are being made here in the United States, but I think it's important in the reasoning for this book and the reasoning for my work is that even if we are to successfully eradicate fentanyl from the planet, not just the United States, but the planet, if we don't start dealing with the demand side
right.
of the addiction crisis,
yeah, that's where I want to end up here. That's where I want this conversation to go. You know, so, you know, the drug addiction is a part of the crisis of despair. It's a part of our disease of despair that we have in the United States. And that should be addressed. But I want to try, we're talking about what are the myths of fentanyl? And so many were being fed in the news all the time. But one thing is, like, for example, you're talking about the labs and the manufacturing of fentanyl. You know, you can make fentanyl, and I've seen video of this, of people making fentanyl over a campfire in a bucket. It's not a lab. It's just a mixing of chemicals together over an open flame.
Correct. And
it's not complicated stuff. This stuff can be made in the crudest of forms. It's you know, to try to say fentanyl, we can block it, we can stop it, you know, it's
well,
here.
This has been one of the uniquely American problems, but also uniquely American ways of dealing with the drug crisis in the United States is othering, right? We never look inwards.
Sure.
I think part of, you know, where I get frustrated with the discourse and the discussion around the fentanyl crisis is we continuously talk about it as a foreign policy problem. It is a domestic policy problem, right? There, we need to look inward at our own failures here with our domestic policy that have led to such a catastrophic drug crisis such as fentanyl. And you bring up myths and misinformation. You know, one of the reasons I believe that we are in many respects going backwards in terms of the policy of addressing the fentanyl crisis is because of a lot of these fantastical stories, right, that we hear in the media. And the media does have a large part to play here. We have heard,
but the media only is reliant upon law enforcement for a lot of their information about this. And
somewhat they report on suspected stories, you know,
right,
that they've heard, but they also don't do the follow-ups.
Sure.
When you
okay.
know what,
so we'll
what
talk about fentanyl and the Halloween candy coming up here after this break. You know, this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're talking about Fentanyl Nation, a new book out by Ryan Hampton, and he is a recovery advocate, and he is trying to set the record straight. What is fentanyl? How is it impacting the United States? Only when we get real about this are we going to find real solutions. And you can call in at 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source continues right after this. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The new book, Fentanyl Nation, Toxic Politics and America's Failed War on Drugs, shatters many of the myths that we have been exposed to as we are dealing with a fentanyl overdose crisis in the United States. That is not a myth. That is real. There are real people losing loved ones because of fentanyl. It's only by getting real that we're going to be able to find solutions that will work. We're joined by the author of the book, Ryan Hampton, and he is a recovery advocate. He's also a Democratic candidate for the Assembly in Nevada. So how is that going for you, Ryan?
Oh, it's interesting. I mean, you know, I wrote this book Really, I started it 2 years ago, and as you can see in the subhead, it talks a lot about toxic politics. It's been an interesting race. You know, I've been talking about addiction, recovery, overdose, solutions to the crisis, but also how a lot of the issues our neighbors are facing, right? Access to housing, access to healthcare, access to high-paying jobs, you know, finding purpose in community. You know, these have a direct nexus to people who are seeking recovery from substance use disorder. But what has been really interesting is, you know, my opponent pretty much just fanning the flames of my own personal story, my own journey in recovery, and using fear-based tactics, you know, specifically around fentanyl and addiction to keep people from supporting me or even wanting to talk about me and or talk to me. And I think it just it almost proves the hypothesis of the book, in a sense, that this issue around addiction and overdose and fentanyl gets weaponized when we get close to an election. But what really frustrates me is, look, I think it's great that we're opening up a dialogue about this issue and this cause within our communities. But after the election, what happens? Usually not much, right? We use these fear-based tactics to drive people to the polls, but then we don't really get very serious about solving the problem. And I argue, and this is in the book and in my work and even as a candidate, that we need serious people. We need serious people running. We need serious people who are in public policy, who are truly committed to finding pragmatic solutions to this crisis, which we know exist, right? We don't need to recreate the wheel. There's things we could be doing right now, as opposed to looking at policies from 40, 50 years ago that we know don't work.
So Halloween is coming up here right before the election. Last year, there was this huge myth that was reported on, you know, broadcast media on the TV stations about how, look out for fentanyl being given away to kids as they go trick-or-treating. They were warning about rainbow fentanyl. Did that ever happen?
No, it did not. And this is where, you know, case in point, the media does have a big responsibility here, because they also never reported or did a follow-up that this was not happening on any type of mass casualty scale. Quite frankly, it didn't happen at all. These fantastical stories that pop up on the internet, I believe, are, you know, let's just like look as a baseline. Fentanyl is scary enough without having to add in these myths and misinformation about it. The rainbow fentanyl was a complete myth. It never happened. There are stories that you hear from time to time in local media and sometimes even national media over folks who have touched fentanyl or had quote unquote fentanyl exposure and they have overdosed. That is not true.
Right. So can fentanyl be absorbed through the skin?
It cannot. It cannot be absorbed through the skin. This has been debunked time and time again.
I've heard stories of like someone in law enforcement saying he touched something while searching a car and he started feeling like he was going to have a fentanyl exposure, overdose, and he self-administered Narcan and saved
himself.
Which
you can't do.
Which is like, that didn't happen.
Right. You cannot, if you are truly overdosing, you cannot administer yourself Narcan. You are unconscious. You are unable to revive yourself, which is why it's important that, you know, everybody carries Narcan in case you do come in contact with somebody that is overdosing, that you can administer it to them. I go into great length actually in the opening of this, because if I could really drill down to a moment, right, where this misinformation just hit top of headlines, everything from the New York Times to the Washington Post to CNN. It was when Officer Chris Green in East Liverpool, Ohio, his story of a supposed fentanyl overdose went viral in 2017. And there was no fact checking. There was no follow-ups to it. It was just, we were led to believe that what Officer Green was saying was true. And even to this day, you know, there was never any toxicology information that was available to the public. And we see this same playbook play out around the country. Look, I, in my capacity as a candidate and also as a community member here in Southern Nevada, I met with a group of law enforcement you know, just a couple of weeks ago who are on the opioid task force here. And one of the questions I had for them was, have you ever experienced issues with fentanyl exposures? And they're like, no, this is actually quite ridiculous. Like, they have been, you know, in the presence of fentanyl multiple times through drug seizures. Nobody has felt like by scooping it up and putting away that it was any different than cocaine. Now, look, it is dangerous, right? It is definitely dangerous. It is something that maybe, you know, it would make sense to be wearing like an N95 mask, you know, so you don't inhale it if you want to have extra precautions. But these stories and tales that we hear, there's a real, people don't, you know, people say, but the pushback I get on this is, but we should be, you know, overly concerned as a prevention tool. I will tell you that some of these stories have really adverse, terrible public policy consequences, right? And also real world consequences. I spoke to in the midst of writing the book, an EMT, a firefighter, you know, who really wasn't well read in on the facts versus fiction on fentanyl, and was quite frankly afraid, you know, to administer Narcan, to get close to somebody who was overdosing, because they didn't want to inhale or to touch fentanyl that may be on them. I've talked to folks who are afraid to administer rescue breathing to someone, right? We have seen policies that have been explored in certain states to label fentanyl a weapon of mass destruction, akin to anthrax, right? And
fentanyl is still used in hospitals.
Exactly.
It is a capital F fentanyl. You know, there's lowercase fentanyl, which is like the street drug. It's not the uppercase fentanyl is used in hospitals. This is a necessary prescription drug to help people who are in extreme pain and dealing with the final days of life.
Which is something that I explore too and talk about a lot in the book, because there has been a community that is left behind in this discussion, and that is folks who have chronic pain and who rely on medications such as fentanyl, you know, for quality of life, you know. And some of the saddest stories that I've heard are pain patients, right? And I write about a woman named Anne towards the tail end of the book, who has to go to multiple states, you know, taking Greyhound buses to get her prescription fentanyl because pharmacies aren't really carrying it anymore. Pain patients are stigmatized from using it. There is a very big difference between the illicit fentanyl that is manufactured, you know, illicitly on the street, and pharmaceutical grade fentanyl, which is used every single day in hospital settings across the United States and has been, you know, a game changer. You know, most folks don't realize that, you know, fentanyl isn't like this new drug that popped up. It was actually synthesized by a Belgian chemist named Dr. Paul Janssen in 1959. He was tinkering with the molecular structure of morphine. And in that same lab, within 1 year, Janssen and his team synthesized, you know, more than 500 new chemical compounds, and most famous, you know, now actually quite infamous, is fentanyl. This has been a staple of Western medicine for some time, and there are pain patients across the country who have been adversely impacted by some of this, you know, knee-jerk reactionary policy, because doctors are now afraid to prescribe fentanyl or are afraid to administer it, and pain patients are committing suicide across the United States. They are, their quality of life has decreased significantly, and nobody is really talking about that, you know, mirrored crisis that is going on as a result of some of this really bad policy and some of this, not some of this, a lot of this misinformation out there.
So we've talked about Narcan a little bit, so let's dive into that. So Narcan is a drug that is inert. It will not harm you if you are not overdosing on opioids. It is readily available. I was able to go to my drugstore and just ask for it, and they gave it to me for free. You know, this is something that everyone, especially if you have a teenager person living in your home, you should have this.
Absolutely. So, you know, Narcan went over the counter about a year and a half ago. It is the overdose reversal drug medication. It is completely harmless and safe. It is administered through the nose. You should be able to find it at any pharmacy. It is over the counter. One of the issues that I actually talk about in the book, though, is you can get it for free if you have commercial insurance. You can get it for free from your public health department. But the cost, if you are to purchase it over the counter, is somewhere between $40 to $50. I believe that in the midst of a public health crisis, such as the overdose crisis, you know, at least in the short term, we should be making Narcan available for free. Naloxone, which is the generic form of Narcan, can be manufactured for you know, barely a nickel. We were able to actually, you know, we were able to distribute and administer a free vaccine throughout COVID. I see, you know, the wide availability of Narcan as a similar necessity to end overdose. And now we actually have empirical data, you know, that supports this. Just 2 weeks ago, the new revised overdose statistics were released by the CDC, which showed a 10% decline in overdose deaths nationally since last year. And while we're still collecting data, Dr. Nora Volkow, which is someone who I greatly admire, she's the head of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, has worked for multiple presidential administrations, red, blue, everything in between, Trump, Biden, a complete nonpartisan. You know, she credits the wider availability of Narcan coupled with the wider availability of medications for opioid use disorder as one of the reasons. The United States Surgeon General issued a Surgeon General's warning 2 years ago requesting that all Americans carry Narcan on them and know how to use it. So I think that this is a big piece of the puzzle, but we have to go, that's keeping people alive, right? Narcan is one of the first steps. It's keeping people alive, but then we really need to dive deeper to make sure that we get them on a road to wellness and to become their best selves and into recovery. And there's many strategies that I think the U.S. you know, falls down on to be able to accomplish that goal.
You talk about toxic politics. I mean, it did. There was a lot of opposition to getting Narcan available, put in law officers' units, making this freely available because they thought we were going to just empower people to overdose.
Oh, it is one of the most ridiculous and frustrating things that I face every single day. Look, I mean, Narcan didn't just show up overnight over the counter. There was a lot of blood spilled over that. You know, my advocacy organization and many of us on the ground doing this work started calling for this as early as 2018. In 2019, the FDA scientific advisory panel, made the recommendation that Narcan go over the counter. I can remember in 2017 when I lost my friend Tyler to an overdose in a recovery home, and I was frustrated because there was no Narcan there. I was told that it was Tyler's fault, not their fault, that they didn't carry Narcan. There's a lot of old thinking that still exists around, you know, the disease of addiction, particularly when it comes to opioids, and people thinking that having Narcan on hand or within a close proximity of somebody who may need it, that you're providing them a crutch. And a lot of those same, you know, old attitudes go for things like methadone and buprenorphine, right?
Right. Where so we can talk about that when we come back from the break. I got to hit this break. But I really want to come talk about how, fentanyl is in these pills that are being sold. Kids are getting, you know, they think they're getting just buying an Oxy. Instead, one pill can kill. We're going to talk about that. We'll take your calls, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The fentanyl flow in the United States. The source continues after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In 2023 alone, Customs and Border Protection seized over 23,000 pounds of fentanyl at the southern border of the United States. The fentanyl crisis, it's real. It's killing tens of thousands of people, Americans, every year. We're starting to see a downtick in that, but we're still, this is early preliminary information, but it is still one of the it is killing so many people that we have to come up with a broad range reality-based solution to try to figure out how do we address the fentanyl problem. The new book, Fentanyl Nation, Toxic Politics and America's Failed War on Drugs. The authors with us are Ryan Hampton is here. So, Ryan, when we're talking about people who are overdosing on fentanyl, some people may think, oh, we're talking about, you know, drug addicts or whatever, but it's that's not necessarily the case. These are not people who are always, you know, they're addicts or dealing with a substance abuse disorder. They may have just gotten a pill at a party and decided to give it a try. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's one of the more catastrophic, you know, outcomes that we've seen is with this poisoned, you know, contaminated drug supply. So things like fentanyls, right? Fentanyl precursors, small amounts of fentanyl, sometimes larger amounts of fentanyl are being pressed into what we call fentanyls, which are like Oxycontin or Adderall or Xanax or, you know, pills made to look like legitimate medications with fentanyl being placed into them. And typically these are sold or traded over the internet. And young kids really are more impacted at a disproportionate level from at least the data that we have by these fentanyls. Kids are, you know, going online, they're experimenting with drugs, they're buying from an illicit market. Fentanyl is showing up in these, you know, fake Oxycontin or fake Xanax or fake Adderalls. They're taking it one time and they're dying. And unbeknownst to them. So it is, I think, very important, really important, you know, given just the widespread availability of these fentanyls that exist, that we look at drug checking technology that can be used in real practical ways, such as fentanyl test strips, right? So, you know, I think it's one strategy that folks will have is just the just say no, right? Don't use drugs no matter what. Look, if that works for you, great. But I think the reality is that young folks are going to experiment. Some young folks are going to experiment with drugs and they shouldn't die as a result of it. We need to make sure that we're, you know, mitigating that harm and, you know, preventing that death the best we can. And one of the easiest things and easiest tools that we have to deploy are fentanyl test strips. Fentanyl test strips are still criminalized in some states. In the United States, I think that, you know, advocates have been doing a lot of work to try and decriminalize fentanyl test strips because it is a practical way of making sure that, you know, folks have the access to this checking technology, make sure there is no fentanyl and that they're actually using a, you know, a legitimate, you know, prescribed drug, something that they think that they're using.
Well, I mean, I was going to say this. You don't need anything you buy off the street is going to have fentanyl in it. That's just the way it is. Anything
more than
buy,
likely,
and if
yes.
I, and if
more
I go to, likely, yes. If I go across the border into Mexico, where they have a lot of pharmacies and a lot of people do that to buy affordable medication, everything there that you buy that is supposed to be like Oxy and all that kind of stuff is going to have fentanyl in it. I mean, it is everywhere.
Right. I mean, it is everywhere. I mean, this is, we know that a lot of the pharmacies, that the Los Angeles Times did a great story on this, a great
right.
series.
They went
on
across,
this last
they bought
year.
Everything, and then they tested it.
Right.
And they found everything across the board had fentanyl in it.
And they did nothing about it. Right. I mean, that was like one of the more frustrating parts is the DEA. It actually took them like a year and a half until they actually took action on that. So, you know, it is the drug supply that we live in these days.
Right. So, I mean, the best advice you can tell your kids, don't take, I mean, but is that practical? Because a lot of kids are dealing with anxiety issues and.
Right. This is where the practical part of this is that we have to look, and I argue that, again, it's the supply-demand argument, right? We need to look at the underlying factors of why these kids are reaching for a, you know, Oxycontin or a Xanax online in the first place, right? We have to get to those root causes. That's where I believe real prevention exists. We also need a more robust PSA campaign that actually makes sense, right? To make sure that kids know the dangers of getting these medications online or taking a pill from a friend or buying it on the street. Right now, the DEA has got a their one pill can kill campaign, but you know, and I argued this in a New York Post column just 2 weeks ago. I think the messengers really matter when it comes to effective prevention. We should be looking at peers. We should be looking at messengers. We should be looking at evidence-based prevention solutions. When talking to these kids, we don't live in the 80s anymore, where the DARE program that we know—
Well, that was that never worked.
Decades. It didn't work, but we're using
the Reefer Madness techniques. I'm going to go to a caller. Let's go to Frank. And Frank, you're on the air.
It seems like the smartest young kids around my neighborhood have been dying from it, and it's with such a loss for the country. China seems like they have a very productive workforce, and they've controlled their problem. What can we learn from China?
Well, Frank, thank you for calling in. So bringing up China brings up two main issues. Frank brings up the point that this fentanyl overdose problem is a uniquely United States problem, but also we should dive into the fact that these precursor chemicals that are used to make fentanyl come from China. There are conspiracy theories out there that China is doing this deliberately in order to attack the United States. So can I get your reaction to that?
Yeah. I mean, I would say we have to deal in facts and not fiction. You know, the United States by far has the highest drug overdose death rate in the world. We also consume 80% of the world's opioids, right? That should tell you something right there. I wouldn't make the argument that China has this under control. What I would make the argument, and let's not look at China as the example, but we could look at other parts of the civilized world on how they have dealt with their drug problem. I think that they have invested, you know, substantially into public health solutions. What is different here in the United States is that we consistently address our drug problem very lopsidedly as let's just stamp out the drugs and everything else will be okay. We have failed catastrophically at building a public health and a behavioral health system that supports people and gets people the support that they need when they need it. I just looked at a swing state poll the other day, right, showing the top issues for voters. They included expanding Medicaid coverage, lowering costs of prescription drugs, it's expanding safety net benefits, shoring up vet funding for healthcare. These issues are very popular, and I think they directly touch the crisis of addiction and overdose that so many everyday people are struggling with. People want quality, affordable healthcare, which includes addiction treatment that's affordable and actually works. But here in the United States, nearly 40% of qualified addiction treatment providers will not provide the gold standard for opioid use disorder, buprenorphine and methadone. You know, methadone, when people suffer a mental health crisis, they need therapy. When a loved one needs treatment, people need access that isn't without these massive financial burdens and insurance burdens, questioning what insurance will cover or won't cover. Our systems come a long way, but there's still, you know, a very long way to go to make sure that people can access quality care. I would also say that some of these conspiracy theories and, you know, information that you hear about how great it is and how China has it under control, or how, you know, executing drug dealers is going to stamp out the problem. That's information that we hear from these governments. I mean, when we talk about China, and I always find it fascinating when people talk about how great China has everything under control. I mean, this is a communist country that is known for broadcasting misinformation and only information that they want other countries to hear, right? I think we need to look here in the United States and say, hey, you know, we are failing at this because we're only addressing one side of it. That is what is so, we have done such an awful job here in the United States when it comes to healthcare. You cannot divorce healthcare and ending the overdose crisis. The overdose crisis and addiction treatment has been for far too long the redheaded stepchild of the American healthcare system. One of the simplest things we can do is Medicaid, increasing Medicaid reimbursement rates, increasing Medicaid expansion where we can. Folks who need access to qualified care, you know, don't show up with the best commercial health insurance plan. Oftentimes they have to rely on the public system to get help. I know I did. If it wasn't for Medicaid, I probably would be dead today.
Well, that's that's a way to leave a sentence. Well, sorry, I got to hit this break right now, but when we come back, I do want to hear your story of recovery. It's very similar to the ones that a lot of people have experienced. It started with pain and dealing with pain from an injury, and then next thing you know, you're trying to, you know, you're hooked. And thank you, the Sackler family. Let's take a break here. The number to call in is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source continues right after this. Listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the fentanyl crisis. We're joined by the author of the new book, Fentanyl Nation, Toxic Politics and America's Failed War on Drugs. Ryan Hampton is with us. But I want to get to your story in just a second, but first I want to ask you about this. Last week, the U.S. House Foreign Affairs Committee voted unanimously to pass the Dispose Act, a bipartisan legislation that is supposed to curb fentanyl trafficking by dealing with the precursor drugs that do come in from China, trying to make them harder to import and trying to become a way to crack down on fentanyl. And ask you, our local Congressman Joaquin Castro introduced this act as an effort to try to address the fentanyl crisis. Do you see this as, will this have an impact?
You know, I think in the short term, it may have an impact. But I think, you know, one of my dear friends and somebody I respect very much, Congressman David Trone of Maryland, outgoing Congressman David Trone, he's the chair of the bipartisan Congressional Mental Health and Substance Use Task Force. You know, he has talked about dealing with the precursors in China, you know, akin to being a hydra, right? We, you know, may be able to put in some sanctions that reduce the supply of precursors coming from China. But if we are to eliminate and stamp them out from China, it's probably just going to move over to India. And then from India, we don't know where else it goes, right? It's this game of whack-a-mole. So I think, you know, a lot of these are short-term, you know, Band-Aid solutions that may be helpful in the short term, but aren't really looking at the long game here on how we really meaningfully reduce overdose deaths in the United States. Because like I said earlier in the show, you know, it's fentanyl today, it will be something tomorrow. You know, and certainly with the surge in AI, you know, and being able to come up with new chemical compounds, I believe, for synthetic drugs, we're headed down a very, you know, steep and dark path if we don't start to look at the supply side. I'm sorry, the demand side of this problem very seriously.
Right, so let's talk about the demand side because part of the problem why it's so difficult to come up with political solutions is to this complicated public health problem is because people in politics can be so judgmental. And of course, it's, as you say, toxic politics. There's a lot of blame game going on. And so when we hear like a story like your story, we can see how there are people who had no plans to become addicted, to become involved in this world, but there you end up that way, and needing help, and when help is available, you can get out of it. Can you talk about how you ended up becoming addicted?
Yeah, sure. I once had a career in public policy. As a young person, I was very involved in government and worked for Republicans and Democrats and campaigns and elections. And in 2003, I was on a hiking trip right outside Washington, D.C. I injured my ankle and my knee, ended up in the care of an urgent care physician who told me I needed to get that knee checked out at some point and possibly get an MRI. And in the meantime, prescribed me Dilaudid, which is also known as hydromorphone. It's a very high-grade opioid. And I had been dealing, you know, my father had recently passed away. I had a lot of trauma that had been going on in my life. And I went back for another prescription and a third time for another prescription, and they gave it to me. And the nexus of my story, though, was I had moved back home to Florida, which is where I'm originally from, and went to go see my primary care physician at the time and told him I had this issue with my knee and my ankle. I had been on prescribed pain medication. I was not abusing it. I was not misusing it. And I needed to continue the prescription or figure out what to do or get the knee and ankle fixed. And he said he didn't deal with that kind of pain. He didn't deal with that kind of medicine and referred me to a pain specialist and found myself in Broward County, Florida, in a pain doctor's office, unbeknownst to me, which was a pill mill. If you know anything about the three waves of the overdose crisis, the first wave being with pharmaceutical opioids, the hotbed for that, really one of the origin locations was South Florida in Broward County, and I was caught up in the middle of it. And the doctor I went to see said, hey, you know, all we really actually need to do is take you off this current medication you're on and put you on this new medication that just came out. It has less than 1% addictive risk. It's called OxyContin. You take it twice a day, every 12 hours. And it's going to really help you out a lot. To make a long story very short, my journey into full-blown substance use disorder and chaotic addiction was not protracted from there. It was within, you know, two and a half, three years that I was unemployable, had lost my housing. I had my first attempt at treatment, was never offered buprenorphine or methadone.
Well, let me ask you a question here. Did you start that downward spiral while you were on that pill mill's OxyContin, or was it when they cracked down on it and they started shutting down these pill mills and people started looking out for street heroin?
Well, let's say that my life progressively got worse, even while I was on the OxyContin, because my tolerance level was going up. So I was requiring, they kept upping my dose, and then they were layering in other opioids as breakthrough medications in the middle. But where, you know, it all really did come crashing down on me was in late 2008, early 2009. I got cut off from prescription OxyContin completely because the state of Florida, this was, you know, when overdose numbers were starting to really show up in communities, and the state of Florida decided the way to deal with it was to, you know, not necessarily shut down the pain clinics at the time, but to shut down problematic users and cut off the supply from them. And if we cut off the supply, the demand would go away. And I showed up at one of the pill mills that I had been seeing one day for my prescription, and I had been flagged in this database, and they cut me off that day. And I was long beyond the position of having a choice at that point. My brain was completely hijacked, and I was in full blown withdrawal. I can remember it as if it was yesterday. And I walked out into the parking lot of that pain clinic, and I was very sick. For anybody who's never been through it, withdrawal feels like you're literally going to die. Your brain circuitry is completely hijacked by the opioids. And walked out of that pain clinic, and there was somebody there, and they said, hey, I have something that'll make you feel better right now. You won't be sick anymore. It's about a quarter of what you're paying for the OxyContin, and gave me heroin. And I remember telling myself, there were so many yets, I was never going to do heroin. And I did it that one time, and it was all bad, all downhill from there. Multiple overdoses. I can say though, I was looking for help badly. And right 10 years ago, actually this week, I was on the streets and my mom thought I was going to die. I thought I was going to die. I didn't have insurance. I had no money. My mom didn't have money to pay for me to go to treatment. But she did say she would help me find a public treatment center. And she helped me find a public treatment center. I had to make a phone call every single morning at 8 a.m. for 30 days until they had a bed for me. And Thanksgiving Eve 2014, the voice from the nurse on the other end said yes. I went into a treatment center. They got me signed up on Medicaid, stayed in that center, transferred to another center after that, got into recovery housing, never wanted to talk about addiction or recovery again. Just wanted to get my life back together. And within a year, had lost six close friends, roommates, people I had gone to treatment with, and was angry. And that's when I started getting involved in advocacy and really looking at addressing overdose as a community problem, but also as a political problem. You know, my recovery is not political. My recovery journey is not political. Nobody's recovery journey is political. It's very personal. It's a story of hope and resilience. But the access to the healthcare supports, the long-term recovery supports, the behavioral health care, the Medicaid, right? The prevention supports, the housing, you know, setting folks up with the best outcomes and, you know, supporting their social determinants of health, which includes jobs and housing and healthcare. Those issues are very political. And I can remember, and I'll end on this note, you know, a time in 2016, right, to 2012, you know, politicians were tripping over themselves to talk about we can't arrest our way out of a public health crisis, right? That the way to end this isn't going to be always through handcuffs, right? That we have to start looking at this more compassionately and getting people the help they need, that's truly the path forward. And I outline, you know, I think 9 very realistic steps in the book on how we can get there. But those days of unity seem to be a distant memory at this point, now that fentanyl has entered the scene, and we're going back to the days of, you know, war on drugs rhetoric and othering, and, you know, the current narrative that surrounds addiction and fentanyl. It's just eerily similar to that of the crack cocaine epidemic of the 1980s, and I argue that that's purely because of politics. Right? We're no longer talking about this in a unifying fashion. And we have to get back to that if we're going to get serious about ending the crisis. Again, it's a balanced approach. Nobody is saying, you know, to not do anything on the supply. Right. All I am arguing is it has to be balanced on parity, supply, and demand.
Brian Hampton is a recovery advocate and the author of the new book, Fentanyl Nation, Toxic Politics and America's Failed War on Drugs. Ryan, I'm so glad you're here. You're around to talk to us today. I appreciate that.
Thank you for having me.
And this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
Has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Kayla Padilla is our booking and engagement producer. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.